perceptions are wrong, your deceptions are right. You look so good in the gaslight. You say I don't know how hard it has been for you to put up with me. You say I've got too sensitive skin. Guess I'll never be free.
And good morning. You are here at Wednesday Talk Radio once again. I am Paul Rowland, your regular host, and I've got Reggie Lee, my first Wednesday co-host. Good morning, Reggie.
Good morning.
And I've got John Harold, my guest, who will be speaking this evening at the Rethinking Psychiatry event, which I'll give the information on in just a second. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Paul.
And we've got Becky Eden sitting in with us. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning.
And just a couple of events after I say that song, very appropriately called Gaslight, was by Mary Hamer. I just happened to find that on YouTube. How appropriate. It's because that's what we are going to be talking about. His theme of his talk tonight is I'm Crazy Because They Say So, Gaslighting in Mental Health. And that's going to be at the Montevilla United Methodist Church from 7 to 9 p.m., that's at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland. And that's the regular Rethinking Psychiatry event. There won't be one next month, but starting again in February, every month. All right, and another event tonight I just wanted to mention, the New Upheavals, Crime, Think, Speak in PDX. That'll be at the Dismantle Change Build Center at 14 Northeast Killingsworth Street. Members of the Crime Think group will be stopping in PDX to drop some knowledge. Strategizing for an era of non-binary conflict. Once upon a time, anarchists saw ourselves as engaged in a two-sided struggle between the common people and the institutions of power. Today, as the future of neoliberalism becomes uncertain and uprisings break out from France to Hong Kong, we increasingly find ourselves in three-way fights that pit us against both the reigning authorities and far-right nationalists driven by their own vision of civil war. All right, so that's the New Upheavals, Crime, Think, Speak in PDX tonight at Dismantle Change Build Center. So we're going to talk about gaslighting, and I know this is something that you've been talking about for several years now. You have some talks on YouTube, one of which I saw that you did this April in Salem. I just want to say that the term gaslight, a little bit of history, we're going to talk about the film as we get into this. The term gaslighting has recently gained greater currency in the age of Trump and fake news, but it's colloquial use to describe efforts to manipulate someone's perception of reality go back to the 1960s. So it's really based on the 1938 play Gaslight and its two film adaptations, most famously the 1944 version directed by George Cukor and starring Ingrid Bergman. Gaslighting refers to the way in the film the husband systematically manipulates his wife, played by Ingrid Bergman, to make her think she's going insane so he can gain control of her property. So, with that, talk about how you came to sort of identify with the idea of gaslighting and how you took that film as sort of a touchstone for how you look at the world in a lot of ways.
Well, that film reminded me a lot of my experience in the mental health system in general, because I had a very unusual experience that got pathologized as mentally ill, as mental illness. I was told that I was bipolar, and you know, I didn't really agree with that assessment when it first happened, but over time, throughout most of the year of 2013, I sort of slowly began to be hypnotized by the label and actually started to view myself as mentally ill. So down the road, when I learned the word gaslight and saw the film, I was, you know, it really struck a chord in me. It felt very familiar to be presented a narrative about myself that was really meant to convince me that there was something wrong with me, that I was crazy. And when I saw the film and learned the story, it was just there were just shocking parallels between what happened to Ingrid Bergman's character and what happens to a lot of us who get locked up in psych hospitals and receive diagnostic labels. I just see a real parallel there. Yeah. And I've been really interested in deception in general. I spent about 10 years of my life studying like state deception, so you know, really big lies that are given to the public, and I've always been kind of fascinated by that. So I see a parallel there between you know, big lies that are told to the public, big lies that are told to people who have unusual experiences, and that film. I just see a lot of parallels there.
So that was actually before I was wondering about the timing. So you were involved in that before you had your extreme experience.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I got to thinking about those things in about 2005, and it really took me down a kind of a wild road.
I guess 9/11 had something to do with that.
9/11 had something to do with it. Yeah, but there's certainly lots of there's plenty of other fruit on the tree when it comes to misleading events.
Indeed. So yeah, I mean the film. Jump in anytime, Reggie. The film really it depicts it in, and I guess a lot of people sort of in our lives maybe have that as a more, if we think about it, if we're able to get the perspective to see it sometimes, and that's the trick of gaslighting,
right?
Is in our intimate relationships, and of course that's the film, mm-hmm. is in the intimate relationship, mm-hmm. that obviously the man who ended up marrying her had married her because he had this whole strategy in mind, and you talk about it as a sort of a systematic deception.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's, I can see how obviously, anyway, the parallels between our intimate lives and then, you know, say in a mental health setting, which is both intimate and institutional at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think both have something in common in that I think a lot of our encounters with the mental health system start out feeling friendly, and that we're told that we're getting the help that we need, and maybe we'll receive that help at first, quote-unquote help, with a smile, okay? So it sounds really friendly, like, oh, thanks for coming in, I'm here to help you, you know? And then over time, it becomes something else entirely. But I see a parallel there, that it starts out by just gaining trust, and then it becomes something quite underhanded.
I'm curious if we could like explore maybe some of the ways in the movie and the film that gaslighting is being utilized, and then maybe explore some of the ways in the mental health system that it parallels.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Does anything come to mind like immediately for you? So there's a couple different ways he's gaslighting, which is funny because in the film he's actually altering the gaslight, is that, you know,
right? He's Charles Boyer is the name of the actor who plays the husband, and he has found a secret entrance to the attic upstairs, mm-hmm. and has found a way to get into the attic without his wife knowing. She
thinks
what's
that in the attic?
The attic contains the jewels, contains her aunt's jewels that are valuable. And while he's up there, he's turning on the lights so that he can do his work up there. Mm-hmm. And the lights are supplied by gas. So when he uses the lights up there, it alters the pressure in the lights downstairs. And so she witnesses this dimming in the lights.
And no one's upstairs, and she also hears some random
She doesn't think anybody's upstairs.
Yeah, her perception,
right. Her perception is that she's alone, but she's hearing footsteps upstairs. She's seeing the lights dim, and you know, at first I thought that he was intentionally dimming the brightness of the lights, but mm-hmm. I think that actually that may have been unintended. There's certainly lots of other intentional mind games happening there, but
the cover-up is intentional.
The cover-up, there we go, the cover-up. Yeah, but she
witnesses... That's really interesting parallel right there, I think, just that, you know, I think there's often not an intention by mental health providers to gaslight somebody, to tell them that their reality isn't real, but they're, you know, it does happen like time and time again. Just wanted to point that out real quick.
And, you know, gaslighting is a word that gets thrown around a lot, and there are many different ways to try to describe it. But if I were going to try to sum up what that word really means, it's when someone tries to destroy your reality by manipulating your memory, perception, and sanity. Hmm. And so in that movie, when you ask, like, what are some of the examples of gaslighting, you know, just right away, so Charles Boyer gives Ingrid Bergman a brooch, and a beautiful brooch, and then recognizes that the brooch is a little fragile, maybe it needs a little help, so he takes it back from her and says that he'll repair it. And then he says, you know, you are forgetful, Paula. You do sometimes forget things. And she says, no, what do you mean? Stop being ridiculous. He says, well, I'm just going to put it in this little bag here so that you will remember it because you are forgetful. So right away, he's starting to name her experience mm-hmm. and identify a quality in her life that she actually hasn't really learned to fulfill yet. But as the movie goes along, then he keeps on setting her up to not remember. Mm. And then when he does that, then he keeps on driving home this point of, Paula, are you forgetting again, Paula? And then over time, she goes, I guess I can't trust my memory at all. And it just happens gradually. But mm-hmm. she begins to internalize that. And it just keeps amplifying that until he really starts making open declarations on her sanity and says that she's mad.
And people in her outside world start validating this narrative that he's producing. You know, like, I think there's a first point where one lady's like, she doesn't seem crazy to me. She seems fine. And, you know, and that's like, you know, when you get a lot of outside sources saying the same thing, you know, all the nurses and the doctors and your friends and your family, it's pretty convincing to, and then you start really digesting that narrative and then you are the sick person. And
yes.
That's very much my experience.
So we're back to talking with John Harold, who's here, who I didn't actually properly introduce. Let me just mention a little bit more about you. You're a speaker and a facilitator in the Hearing Voices Network, which we've talked about on the show. Also, Reggie's been involved in that. You from Gig Harbor, Washington. And his talk tonight is I'm Crazy Because They Say So, Gaslighting in Mental Health. And in his talk, he'll explore diagnosis, useful or manipulative, gaslighting techniques, and how to fight them. You're the founder of Puget Sound Hearing Voices, now in its fifth year of weekly meetings. And you completed your master's program. Was that must have been here in Portland, right?
Yes.
Process, yeah,
that was
the process work.
Yep.
That's something I know you talk a lot about as being a program that produces therapists, people in the mental health field who tend not to be so involved in pathologizing.
Yeah, I mean, process work by definition, it was something that was created by Amy and Arnold Mandel. And it's basically non-pathologizing by definition. So it's a real response to the idea of viewing people as sick. And process work takes a non-pathologizing view, so it does not view people as sick and views unusual experiences as actually meaningful, but not in the frame of disease. And when I first learned about process work, I found it extremely liberating for myself because, again, I had been gaslit into thinking that there was something wrong with me for having an extreme state. And in process work, if you had an extreme state, you're actually kind of sought after and in a way kind of celebrated for actually having entered that kind of state of mind. And that was a real departure from being told that I was bipolar.
And I know that in your talks, you want to make it clear that, you know, even though you're very critical of the mental health field in general because of a lot of these tendencies, a lot of things that you directly experience, a lot of people you know have experienced in terms of being manipulated and not listened to and not understood, you don't want to make a blanket statement about all therapists or all people who work in that field. But you do say that you feel that any diagnosis does have an element of gaslighting in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, one of the things that happens in that movie is that Gregory is Charles Boyer's character's name. He creates misleading experiences for his wife, Paula. And then when she starts to have reactions to these experiences, then he immediately pathologizes them and says, oh, you know, Paula, you're having problems with your memory again, Paula. Are you becoming absent-minded as well as suspicious, Paula? And so he keeps on adding like more and more, I call them diagnoses, even though they're not necessarily in the psychiatric realm until later on in the film. But yeah, there's a lot of pathologizing there.
You know, we did have a caller who asked if we were taking callers, and I'm always a little hesitant around the membership drive time because our time is shorter, but it sounds like we do have a caller who would like to join the conversation. I guess Kevin is on the line. Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, hi, good morning. This fascinating topic. I do have a question for your guest. What is the hope for people who have been emotionally or psychologically given a label and pushed down a course of possibly very damaging chemical treatment and then the loss of esteem and pride in one's community? What is the hope for these folks? Because the system doesn't seem to have any answers for them except to label them non-compliant, difficult to treat, or not knowing that they're suffering from this terrific biochemical disease in their brain.
Is the hope? Thanks for the question, Kevin. I mean, I think the first thing is I would like to see people be able to decide for themselves whether they agree with a label or the treatment that they've received. And I put treatment in quotes. You know, I think I'd like to see people be able to examine these ideas more critically and push back against that. If somebody's received a label and they agree with it, cool. But what bothers me is people being labeled against their consent, against their will, and then having people's identities taken over by the labels. That's a really deep question. We could talk about that for a long time.
And Kevin, I would like to say that the hope is right here, in the sense that you know, I'm somebody that, you know, wasn't in a place to be on a community radio show a while ago, and John is a reason of that. We have a, you know, I think our hope is that we have each other, and this, you know, the more we connect, the stronger we are together. John is somebody that, you know, did a Hearing Voices workshop at Pure Apocalypse a couple years ago, and then I was exposed that way, and it's, you know, it's, I think when we start to have our own realizations about ourselves, and then feel empowered to be part of this movement, I think that that's kind of at least my vision of our hope, that, you know, we'd kind of join shoulder to shoulder kind of thing. Most of us are pretty isolated and feel alone, so I think, you know, we are our own solution in a way.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also, you know, a big advocate of finding out the meaning that in unusual experiences. So, you know, having maybe strange beliefs in an unusual state. I had a number of beliefs that really departed from what those around me believed. I've been working to try to find the truth in those beliefs, and have settled on the idea that they were metaphors. And that there's actually something there. There's something to be explored. There's some kind of truth behind those experiences. And for me, it was Hearing Voices groups where I really first kind of made contact with that idea that experience could be something that I could kind of harvest and mine for meaning, which felt like such a big departure from the language of, you know, you're delusional.
You know, one thing I would like to respond in my own personal experience as well, is that, because I didn't have, we were talking earlier, John, about the nature of our extreme states. I didn't have much, I would say, like the kind of content maybe in terms of ideas and stuff. It was more like just this overwhelming excess of energy. But what I found for myself was that basically it pointed me to what caused it. What, you know, and I don't want to go into all the details, but because I was avoiding, it was basically something that I had, you know, I think deeply suppressed in myself that I was avoiding, that was caused in my own family, society, family. And I just want to, you know, because we're offering this book as a premium, but also because I think it speaks to, you know, it's helpful to have a, it's in order to get out of sometimes like these experiences are so overwhelming that we're kind of like submerged in them, and that then the people around us mm-hmm. are not necessarily helping us get perspective on us. They're yeah. just they're just messing with the perspective that we do have. Mm-hmm. And so I think it helps to have the support, and that can, you know, in people sharing perspectives can help give us. But also I think it helps, and not just intellectually, it helps to have a kind of a perspective of what it is about our society that is so utterly messed up. You know, I think because that's the only solution that I see ultimately is like some kind of fundamental social change. I'm at the point where, I don't know, I think I've gotten enough perspective myself, and I feel like I'm probably not going to slip back into, you know, because I think those extreme states are valuable, but I don't think any of us necessarily want to linger there too much. Are we safe?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's like flying a little too close to the sun.
Yeah.
That was sort of the metaphor that I remember picking up. I don't like the idea of living my entire life in that state, but at the same time, I do welcome picking up a little bit of that state all the time in my daily life. I call it being a little psychotic all the time. So I'm actually always in my daily experience, I'm looking for evidence that that state is actually still with me, and that the reality that I experienced at that time is actually still around. But I'm interested in kind of building tunnels so that I can allow some of that energy into my life without it, like you said, kind of drowning me or taking me over. And that was definitely the experience at the end of 2012, was that the state became so big that I could no longer really inhabit consensus reality. And I'm interested in actually inhabiting consensus reality and being psychotic at the same time. That makes my life far more interesting, far more meaningful.
But if we could establish a better consensus reality.
A better consensus reality.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, a consensus reality by definition is the reality that we can agree is happening. So it's not really a fixed thing, you know. And that I think that's it's subject to change depending on what we can agree on.
Welcome back. On the show, we have Paul Rowland, myself, Reggie Lee, and John Harold. We're talking about gaslighting today. Part of what we were talking about previously was this, it reminded me of a quote from, I actually don't know who the quote's from, but said that the schizophrenic drowns in the water that the mystic swims in. And, you know, for me, I know that my experience started out very spiritual and has concluded that way. So it's all come kind of full circle. Before the show, we were kind of talking about this idea that, you know, students, you know, in the mental health system get indoctrinated into a certain school of thought. And then, you know, that school of thought is passed down to us, the recipients. And then so there's kind of this gaslighting loop that's occurring. It's, you know, it's very cyclic. And, you know, I think it's really up to people like us that see the system that we're caught in, to speak out about it and to offer a different perspective. One that actually feels, you know, nourishing and like there's a place to heal. I know that for myself, being in the mental health system for a few years, I felt very stuck. I never felt like people were encouraging real development. You know, it's like, you're going to be stuck here and this is where you stay. And, you know, it's like, it's things like the Hearing Voices Network that actually, you know, encouraged me to step out of that. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts around this kind of cyclic pattern that happens. And I think there's, you know, just a multitude of ways that we get stuck in any system of thought. You know, I think it's important to challenge those. Does anything come up for you, John, in the way of, you know, how systems can kind of perpetuate this narrative and how it just kind of energizes itself in a way?
Reminds me of a phrase I remember hearing, that it's hard to back down from an algorithm. Ever heard that phrase?
I haven't heard that.
You know, that I think when people have a certain way of seeing the world, it's very difficult to actually back down from that idea. So, you know, in this case, the algorithm might be that when people have unusual states, that those need to go away, right? That the only way to get so-called better is to have the state be less. And that's pretty huge. I think a lot of the so-called treatments and abuses that happen in the mental health system are really based on that idea that those experiences need to go away. And, you know, in my experience, there were times where I did need to make that experience go away, but the long-term trajectory was actually to make it happen more and actually really welcome in the meaning of those beliefs, but do it in a way where I can kind of straddle multiple worlds at the same time. So I can sit here and be in this radio show right now, and I can, you know, I can kind of drink my coffee and be in consensus reality, and then I'm also in another world entirely, and you know, picking up a lot of signals and symbols that are coming in this room that I believe are happening kind of at a more spiritual level, and I'm really inhabiting both of those worlds at the same time.
It's something that I'm just kind of picking up on in our dialogue here is that there's something like really like in our experience, like that we want to be, we just want to express like the meaningfulness of our experience, and the system is arguing against the validity of, you know, our experience, and it says that, you know, it's biological and it has no merit. Whereas, you know, myself, you know, I you know, had a lot of domestic violence, and I had a lot of voices that were associated with domestic violence. And then when I made that connection, you know, this like voice started calming down. And, you know, when I started, you know, being, when I stopped fighting my experience, it stopped calming down instead of just taking a bunch of meds or something, you know, so.
Yeah. Sometimes I think for me, the real mental illness began when I internalized the sense that there was actually something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And it even got worse when I became so indoctrinated into the idea of viewing myself as mentally ill that I actually started to spread that vocabulary to other people and say, oh, you've had an extreme state too. Hey, look, we're both bipolar. You know, so now I'm actually passing on the propaganda and I didn't intend to, you know, so that brings me back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, our mental health providers, like the character Burns in The Simpsons, you know, excellent, you know, this kind of evil maniacal thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine there are evil maniacal people maybe in any line of work. But what I've come to believe is kind of along the lines of what you were saying there, that maybe there are people who work in the system who have great intent, but they've been indoctrinated by an abusive way of seeing the world.
Absolutely. Wow, I love how you said that. Yeah.
It looks like we may have one more caller. If you have a quick comment or question, go ahead, Mike.
Yes, good morning. I appreciate the discussion. I'm in the I work in the mental health system, and the system is so broken and limited, and it's unable to build community, and that's a frustrating thing. The mental health system's done in silos, and it's done that way for control and the hierarchy. But there, as much as we talk about the problems, there are solutions, and shared power is definitely the way to go within a county, within a city, to talk to through the mental health system. It's going to change society in general if we start with mental health, with the principle of shared power that is shared with peers, with Indigenous people, and with community groups on the ground, that they get 50% of the say in everything, in policy. And there's an Indigenous concept called two-eyed seeing that combines modern perspectives and research with traditional and Indigenous perspectives. Canada's doing a lot of that. These groups organize around both perspectives, and it's very effective. But for now, the people on the ground and the people affected are being censored out of the discussion, and the mental health system is broken because of it.
You know, it brings back a memory of when I was in the hospital. I was there for 5 days, and, you know, I made some close connections with other people who were there. And I remember actually asking the staff, I handed a little piece of paper with my phone number, and I said, you know, could you put this in Matthew's file? He was another patient at the time. Could you put this in his file? Because I would like him to have my phone number so that we could communicate, you know, later. And of course, I mean, I think that stuff just got thrown away in the wastebasket. So there was an attempt that we were making to establish community. And, you know, I would pay mightily to be able to actually make contact with some of the people that I was in the hospital with, but the hospital served as this really strong barrier to community, and actually really kind of helping isolate us from each other. And I wish that hadn't happened, because, you know, if I don't really like the word healing, because it implies illness, but If I were to characterize it as healing, that didn't really happen for me until I went to a Hearing Voices group and actually started to make contact with other people who had also had unusual experiences and were free to frame them in whatever terms they wanted to. But that took a while. I mean, that took about a year to find that sense of community. So I very much agree. And, you know, the caller, you said, you know, 50% of the power, the decisions need to be made by people who with lived experience. And, you know, I want to say, well, why just 50? You know, why not 80 or 100? You know, I think that the people who have lived experience have a great deal of insight. And how about people who have lived experience and are working as professionals?
Well, thank you so much, Mike. We appreciate that call. I'm Paul Roland. I have with me my co-host on the first Wednesdays, focusing on the politics of mental health and liberation. And I also have John Harold, who's going to be speaking this evening at the Monteville United Methodist Church as part of the Rethinking Psychiatry's monthly event every first Wednesday. Starts at 7 o'clock this evening at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland. And Becky Edens has been quietly sitting here in the studio as well. She might have something to say here in a minute. She's a longtime activist in the psychiatric survivors peer support movement. It's gone by many names over the years. And one thing we were, I guess that the caller who talked about that two-eyed seeing, which I would like to learn more about, an indigenous approach, is, you know, since we just had Thanksgiving and KBOO always has a genocide cover-up day, and we're talking about both manipulation of reality and the truth, of manipulation of perspectives, and the cover-up of that manipulation. And it's hard for me not to talk about this subject of gaslighting without, you know, that much deeper reality, which is basically, you know, this culture of gaslighting goes back to the very foundations of the colonization and the institution of slavery and the justification thereof. And I don't know. I know, Becky, I don't know if you can recapture that thought, but you had something, you know, a response to that.
Well, I was, I have another thought. Oh.
Oh, I need to give you my mic.
Oh. Hi. Well, now I'm thinking about something else after you said that. But
go for it.
I was thinking about that. You know, earlier you talked about the gaslighting in an intimate relationship, and I think about people that. So sometimes we forget that there are hundreds of Oregonians that are locked up in the Oregon State Hospital and other institutions right now, and sort of that when you're locked up long term, those intimate, it is a sort of an intimate relationship, because your food, your clothing, your laundry, your everything is dependent on, you know, because people forget that is a. You know, they don't like that's their home, but it kind of is. So it's this intimate relationship. And I think that my experience is that, you know, I remember as a child, because, you know, I wasn't raised in my culture, but I have, you know, my third great grandmother was a full-blood Matol, and the whole Matol people were wiped out. Not all of us, there's some of us that still have Matol blood. And I was thinking about how, when you were bringing up the thing about the indigenous people, and I think, and I just went to Canada, to Montreal, to a Hearing Voices Congress, and got an opportunity to see where tribes are bringing back their traditional medicine and their traditional practices. And I think that that's important, because I know that in my own life, along with the colonization and actually the massacre and killing of the Matol people in my own family, also alcohol was introduced, you know, in the same way that the parallel to for us that have these extreme states or experiences, we go to the system for help, and then pharmaceuticals are induced. So when the pharmaceutical was induced, or in my dad's case, the alcohol was induced, it sort of robs you of cognitive liberty, of access to those, to reasoning, so that you can have protection against the gaslighting that happens to you. So when I was involuntarily committed and drugged what happened was is that under the influence of that medication, it was easier to brainwash me. It was easier for those ideas to be ingrained into me, you know. And also, I remember working at the Oregon State Hospital and having, you know, having, as it were, relatives of people with Native heritage that their spiritual experiences right away were pathologized. And really, seriously, everybody's experience was pathologized. Humor was pathologized. Mm. Everything was pathologized. And people were drugged as a result. But I think about that parallel, and I don't think that we can forget. You know, I don't, because sometimes people think that the choice to take medication is voluntary. But when you're not given informed choice about it, and you're, it really becomes involuntary in a way. So I just encourage people to come tonight and hear more what John has to say. But
yeah, I have a flood of memories right now about being hospitalized and the, again, the kind of subtle nature of the coercion, you know, because no one actually held me down and forced me to take pills. I know that they do that to some people, but it was really obvious to me when I was hospitalized that was really the means to get out, that the only way to get out was to comply. And taking Zyprexa, which, by the way, that's a very hard tranquilizer, that made me more compliant, you know. It just made me more of a yes man. And I actually have a memory that was coming back to me of actually going back to the hospital in the a couple of weeks following after I got out. And, you know, I thought they were my friends. I thought that the staff at the hospital meant me well. And so I was in this very generous kind of state of mind of wanting to give all my belongings away. And so I remember actually showing up at the hospital with DVDs, giving them to the hospital because I wanted people in there to play them. But I had this really friendly attitude, and it took me time. It really helped when I got off psychiatric drugs. It took me time to sort of recognize that something really coercive had happened. But I was altered enough that it was hard to really notice that while it was happening. And, you know, that kind of brings me to maybe one of the strategies that I might recommend employing when it comes to kind of fighting back against gaslighting. And that would, it's really not a strategy at all. It's just being aware. It's being aware that someone is messing with your head. I think that when you become aware that someone is actually trying to trick you, then it becomes much harder to be under the influence of that trickery.
And of course, we didn't really get to the sort of the conclusion of the film and sort of how Ingrid how the spell is broken finally. I guess that's a good way to put it. The spell is broken, although, you know, there's a good sense for being under a spell, and then there's a bad sense. I guess that's the double-edged sword of so many of these things that we're talking about. But we don't have any more, we don't have much more time to go into that. We would like to, I know you're going to talk a lot about sort of a really in-depth, intimate look at the film and sort of analyze the what goes on. I know you have a bunch of clips. Mm-hmm. People should really see that film. There's two versions of the film, and then there's a play, and there's a few clips on YouTube. Mm-hmm. We showed it, I guess Rethinking Psychiatry showed it last month at the monthly event. But we're just out of time. Last thoughts before, I know it's such a thing to throw out to, because I guess it seems obligatory, but we got to vacate the studio here in a couple minutes. Why should people come and come to the event tonight?
Well, if you've ever been given a psychiatric label or ever been hospitalized, please come, because we're going to, you know, get into depth around some of the trickery that's used around labeling and involuntary drugging. And, you know, I'm just really interested in raising awareness around gaslighting in the general public, because I think that the more you look around, the more aware you become of these techniques, the more you may see them in the news media, at the car dealership, in your relationship. You know, these techniques show up everywhere, so it can become quite colorful and maybe a little disquieting at first. But I think that there's a lot of liberation behind becoming more aware of some of the trickery that's at work in your daily life.
The truth shall make us free. All right,
but first, it will make us miserable.
Got to push through that. Okay, again tonight at the Montaville United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland, starts at 7 p.m. this evening. Thank you, John, Reggie, and Becky. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio.